AI, as a term, originated in 1956 in the US, and was a joint effort by certain academics. Data science is a term that has been around since the 70s, but it really took off as a term around 15 years ago. And it's a term created for marketing purposes. So advancements played a key role in the development of data science. And these were primarily the rise of the internet worldwide, social media, cloud computing, cheaper storage, where essentially many companies found themselves collecting all sorts of data and having no idea what to do with it.
Welcome to Mangtas Nation Season 2. This season is all about tech of the future. We'll be sharing real-world experiences and featuring astounding guests to help guide you in your tech journey. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
The show starts right now.
Hello, everyone. This is Jackie DeMunk, together with Wouter Delbare, and welcome to the Mangtas Nation podcast. In today's episode, we're thrilled to have on board a renowned data science veteran and tokenomics expert. With an impressive academic background in psychology, artificial intelligence, statistics, economics, and a PhD in computer science, he is a true polymath who has worked on various domains, including natural language processing, recommender systems, sports analytics, data culture, and neural networks. He is currently the CEO of Tesseract Academy, an organization that specializes in educating decision makers on deep technical topics like data science, AI, and blockchain. He also serves as the chief data scientist of Electi Consulting and as a chief data officer of Datalist, where he helps professionals become data scientists. Listeners, let us welcome a guest who is currently living and working in London, Dr. Stelianos Stelios Kambakis. Hey, Stelios, thank you for taking the time to join us today, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, everyone. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Now, Stelios, it seems like, you know, after that lengthy introduction, we see and our listeners already hear that you're involved in so many things, and, you know, we barely know where to begin. But, well, probably the best place to start would be to tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, and then we can branch out from there.
Yeah, sure. So I've been in the space of data science and AI for about 10 years now, and I think I've been in Web3 for the last 6 years now or so. I've done a little bit of everything in my career. So in terms of technology, I've done, you know, from like deep learning to statistical modeling, all the way to education. In the last few years, I spent a considerable amount of my time simplifying data science and either helping students become data scientists or executives and companies to better understand data science. I've also published 2 books, and there's going to be a third one coming out this year about the history of data science, the last one that is. So very happy about that. And within Web3, I specialize in the area of tokenomics, as you quite accurately mentioned. And essentially, my main expertise within data science is around modeling, right? And I was one of the first people to take token economics seriously as a field and apply certain methodologies for the analysis of token economies, like agent-based modeling. And this is how one thing led to another. And then now these days I find myself spending half my time in working on token economics. So I guess I split my time in between a few different activities, like the Tesseract Academy, writing books, teaching, consulting for various companies. And I also recently joined Hackian, which is a very big smart contracts auditing firm, because they're starting a new division on tokenomics auditing, which we believe is going to be the next big thing in tokenomics, since we saw many issues on, like, with FTX, Terra Luna crashing, which means that the whole Web3 space, if they want to be taken more seriously, they need to start thinking about some kind of auditing and oversight. So that's like a brief overview. And at any given moment in time, I'm involved in a few different things. And I just want to note now, DataList has been renamed to Beyond Machine, in case anyone wants to look it up on Google. Because they won't find the previous data, the old website, they'll find like a new website. Just
what we'll make sure to include it in the show notes.
Yeah, thank you.
And maybe just taking a little bit of a step back, right? So where did it all begin? Where are you from originally? Tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today, including your interest in data science, right? What sparked that? And why did you start to specialize in all of that?
Yeah, that's actually a very long story, because I started on this journey around 2009, which now feels like a lifetime ago, and it makes me feel a bit old. But my initial studies were in cognitive psychology. So I wasn't interested in technology per se. I was mostly interested in the human mind. And towards the end of my studies, I was doing one of those comprehensive degrees in back in Greece, where you specialize in one thing, but you also have to do like other stuff as well. So where I'm going with this is I specialized in cognitive science, but also had to undergo some clinical practice, etc. I'm like, I'm not really sure this is for me. You know, I'm really interested in the study of the human mind and intelligence and philosophy of mind. And then I decided to switch over to study exactly that, right? So then I moved out of Greece. I went to the UK, did a master's in the University of Edinburgh. And I was pretty determined to become an academic. And this is when I moved from Scotland to London, to UCL. And that was then I realized that maybe academia is a bit slow moving. And while I was in the process of actually doing research, I'm like, you know, I probably overestimated the impact that academia has on the real world. That's not to say that there are not serious academics out there, but for better or for worse, and I hope I don't offend anyone there, I think academics with a real impact on society are the minority, no matter what most people think. It's a bit like if you ask people how well they drive, the majority will say that they're above average drivers, which obviously statistically doesn't make any sense, right?
Or and how well I pronounce your name.
Yeah, exactly. That wasn't just a compliment. That's when I'm like, okay, I'm going to be out of academia. I mean, I'm still affiliated with certain institutions like UCL, London Business School, Cambridge, and some others like the Cyprus International Institute of Management, but as an external, right, either teaching or advising students, etc. And since then, I embarked on my own journey of essentially trying to figure out, you know, what I can do with data science, right? So I was, and what I realized is that what I really like doing in terms of applying data science to real world problems is two things. One is either helping startups to innovate or help organizations senior executives to better understand data science. And then a close third is helping people start a career in data science. I say close third because this has always been there for me, you know, because I've been teaching since university. And then you might ask me why startups. So the thing with startups is that I think they're always more exciting. So what I notice is that with bigger companies, I like educating decision makers, talking with them. Yeah, but I mean, you see, you run a startup, right? So you know what I'm talking about. But bigger companies are a bit slow moving. So you can have interesting conversations, but working with them in the actual implementation of the proposals can be, it's quite different, right? It can be a bit slow. It's a bit of a slow process. It's quite different. Mm-hmm. Where startups can be more dynamic, can be faster. You build more personal relationships. You meet people. So there's also this social aspect, which I very much enjoy. So this pretty much sums up. You know, it's a quick overview of my journey. There are some other aspects which probably I didn't expand too much upon, like tokenomics or, you know, a prior interest in computational neuroscience, which unfortunately I don't really have the time to pursue this anymore. It's an interesting but very academic field.
So many things to learn in so little time.
Yeah, exactly. This knowledge keeps... sorry, just a note there. This is something I realized when I was determined to become an academic. I was obsessed about learning. And now that most of my work is within the industry, I'm not doing, let's say, proper work per se. Research or anything like this, but I'm like essentially applying the things I know, I realized that it's just so difficult to keep up with every new development. And I think at the pace that we see everything progressing, I don't think it's possible for someone to know everything. And I don't even, it's crazy to think what's going to happen when new iterations of large language models like ChatGPT, they essentially reach a point where they can also produce their own research, because, you know, one of their main weaknesses now is they can't really think in a logical way. They fake logical thinking, but imagine if they can start writing their own proofs and all that. It's crazy. That's why in my work, I'm still trying to keep up, obviously, with recent developments, but what I find out, it most often comes down to applying the basics in a very thoughtful way, rather than just trying to always look for the new shiny things, unless there's a very good reason for you to do that. It's like a general approach in how I solve problems.
And would love to ask you a lot more, especially tokenomics, Web3, and all that. We definitely want to go down that path. But before we do, we noticed that you did a very interesting PhD on a topic that we're very passionate about, which is footballers and injuries. Can you tell us a little bit more? Because I could have probably been pro if I wasn't injured that much. So we'd love to understand that a little bit better.
Yeah, that's a funny story. Like, I actually got a scholarship to study this because I was admitted to UCL, and there were essentially four programs I could choose from. They were like, because the university had arrangements with companies to fund students for particular areas, and essentially they told me, okay, you have a very good background, you know, you can choose any of them. So there was one like on retail analytics, something else on, I don't remember, probably it was finance or something. there was this one that was funded by Tottenham Hotspur. And no one wanted to touch this because most of the computer science PhDs, they never had anything to do with sports in their entire lives. So I'm a very bad football player. It's probably also because of my... because of my body, right? If you see me, I'm more like a rugby player than an actual football player. Even though if someone's listening from America, they'll be like, oh, you know, that's the same thing. But in Europe, they're not, you know?
No.
If you're based in America, you know? And but I'm a fitness enthusiast.
We'll put the differences in the show notes as well.
Yeah.
We'll ask ChatGPT to summarize it. How about that?
Yeah, it's football, but you played with your hands. Anyway, it's a bit confusing. But but essentially no one wanted to touch this, and I'm a fitness enthusiast, so I'm like, okay, because that's like a completely new area, maybe I can make a dent in that area. So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna go for this. And I was working with the medical department. In our main, we worked on two things: predicting injuries or predicting how long it would take to recover from an injury. What I can tell you is that this is actually possible, but there were many real world challenges which made me abandon that area. Essentially, the problem is that in order to do this successfully, you need very good data collection. And in order to do this in a team, especially with professional players, you need to have the right culture and the right mindset. So you really need to have the buy-in from the people, you know, at the top of the hierarchy, saying this is how we run things. And then back then, this was like I practically finished my PhD around 2015, and then I officially graduated in 2016. It was, the tech culture in the Premier League in England, it wasn't that tech friendly. So there were conversations, but it wasn't the best place for a data scientist to be, as in you were like a third class citizen. So I kept doing work in sports, like in other areas, like sports betting or... I worked for a couple of years in a company that was dealing with essentially valuation models for players, but taking into account their social activity and their football skill and things like that. But I never really worked with a football team directly, right, for this particular reason. However, my boss at that time, Wayne Diesel, I hope he's listening to the show. Like, if he's listening, you know, feel free to ping me on LinkedIn. We haven't spoken in years. He moved from the Premier League to the US, and he did a stint in the NFL and then in the NBA. So I think it was Miami Dolphins and then some NBA team. So I haven't spoken to him for a while, but I was very surprised because I'm a member of the Royal Statistical Society, and the Royal Statistical Society and the American Statistical Association, they have a journal called Significance. In that journal, Wayne actually wrote an article talking about the work he was doing in sports analytics in the US, and all of these things were essentially the work that we started in Tottenham, right? And he carried it forward. Which was very exciting, but obviously the difference is that Wayne Diesel is a medical practitioner and a physio practitioner, so he was the head of the medical team. So it's different when he's like, well, this is how we run things, compared to my situation where when essentially I finished my PhD, I was like a junior data scientist, right? And it's one more reason that pushed me towards the startups, because I realized that, again, in startups, you can make like a big difference with your knowledge. Like you can come up with an algorithm or give them a direction, which maybe a few years later, they end up raising like 10 million in funding in Series A or whatever. In a football team, you're not the one who's actually going to make that difference. It's a different game.
And I guess also I can relate to that, right? UK football versus American sports. America is very stats driven, right? Mm. And I remember in the UK and Europe, they were all protesting about VAR, if you're familiar with it, right? Where you take the organic nature out of it, right? So you see these two different mindsets, really. And I can 100% relate to what you're saying.
Yeah.
Now, you're basically doing a lot of things, mm-hmm. right? From Web3 to AI to data science to advisory and much, much more, writing books. Is that by design? Is that how you'd like to, do you like to balance things out and have your tentacles spread across?
Yes, I'm one of those people that started following a portfolio career before such a thing had a name, simply because I realized that I was trying to figure out what to do, right? Because I finished my PhD and I really had a very strong academic background, and then I'm like, I'm quitting academia as a full-time job. And then I started working for a startup full-time, and I'm like, I'm not really motivated with this either. And then I started talking to different people, advising different companies. And then opportunities suddenly started, showing up. And I got used to working in this kind of way, like for years, with different projects, different people, until I realized that, okay, maybe I'm spread out too thin, right? So there's obviously, there can be too much of a good thing, which is essentially you can't really push anything forward because you're spread out too thin. And that's when I realized, okay, I need to essentially keep this portfolio career, but do it in a bit more structured way, which is where I currently stand. And I also make sure that the things I'm doing, they all like have a common theme. So, for example, Tesseract Academy is data science education for executives and consulting for companies, right? Then Beyond Machine is data science education for those who want to become data scientists. I work in Web3, but I work in token economics, which is essentially data science and economics, right? So, and my books, they're all about data science. So I'm involved in all these different things, but I realized one way to make this work is to just marry everything under one theme and make sure that, they somehow feed into each other. They're not just random. So it's not like I also run an e-commerce store and I sell protein powders. You know what I mean?
Well, excellent. Being entrepreneurs ourselves, Stelios, you mentioned Tesseract Academy, and you specialize in educating decision makers or executives about data science. What inspired you to start your company?
I just saw the need for it, to be honest with you, because when I was working on my PhD in Tottenham, I was under the illusion that being very proficient at the technical level was actually what would make the difference. And then I was, that PhD was essentially the first time I had interacted with a proper big company, right? I was doing some freelancing, but with startups, etc. And then I realized the importance of cultural factors within an organization. And it was the first time this hit me in the face that an organization is an entity with very complex human relationships and rules. And this can be different from one company to another, from one country to another, from a sector to another. It's a very, 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 very complicated problem. And somehow in my head, I thought this was, which is a very common misconception for many people that have a technical background. They think all these matters, like, they're just fluffy, and they're still fluffy, but they're super important. It's just that they're difficult to define because they're so intangible and human and fluid. And I spent, let's say, 3 or 4 years where, on one hand, I had a university that, because it's an elite UK university, I had to do some kind of innovative research to publish it, because otherwise you can't get published. And then an organization that wanted something much simpler, and the main problem lied not in the models, but in the culture. And after like 4 years of doing this, I'm like, actually, that's a more general problem. And I started running some workshops in London, and I saw people started joining those workshops where I would explain data science and AI, et cetera, et cetera. And that went well. And then at some point, like, COVID happened, and I'm like, oh, maybe I can actually try to turn this into a proper company, because I realized that for better or for worse, even if data science now is more mature, is more accepted, developments like ChatGPT have helped break AI into the mainstream, I see that there's still challenges in, you know, how data science and AI is being perceived. And I think that's going to stay there for a while, because even if these technologies, they get, you know, they get adopted by everyone, I think that those professionals that don't have a technical background, they will still need to at least invest a little bit of time to get a basic understanding of you know, of data science and AI. And this is what really motivated me. I mean, basically, I saw the need, and then I received feedback, because, you know, I started the workshops, then from the workshops, I wrote the book, I received positive feedback from that. And, you know, one thing led to another.
Excellent. And would like to ask you a lot of questions. You mentioned culture. I want to go a little bit deeper into that, and even on AI and data science. But before we go there, right, we always find it useful for our listeners to hear your definition of concepts and how you look at these things, right? So before we go a little bit deeper, how would you distinguish data science from AI?
I think that, AI as a term originated in 1956 in the US, and it was a joint effort by certain academics, like, I think, from Carnegie Mellon and IBM and maybe MIT, to recreate intelligence, right, in a machine. And back then, AI, essentially, it was a very specific vision and a very specific approach. And now the vision is still there, but the approach keeps changing. Data science is a term that originated, I mean, it has been around since the 70s, but it really took off as a term around 15 years ago. And it's a term created for marketing purposes. So around the turn of the millennium, we saw advancements which played a key role in the development of data science. And these were primarily the rise of the internet worldwide, social media, cloud computing, cheaper storage, where essentially many companies found themselves collecting all sorts of data and having no idea what to do with it. And then, like, big consultancies, because quite often, as many of these terms, they start from big companies, they realize that, you know, that's like actually a huge market, and companies were asking for this. So this is when we saw the terms big data and data science being used a lot. And this term came about because until that point, if you look into the history of data science, you'll see a bunch of disjoint efforts in different fields to analyze and extract patterns from data in different ways. So if you study the history, this is what my last book actually talks about, because there's a history of doing this since the Middle Ages, which then has taken very different forms. Okay, there have been many, many theories as to how to analyze data, create intelligence, this, that. And again, many of them were disjoint because, let's not forget, and forget your listeners, that's not a given, that the internet has been a staple in our lives only in the very recent history. So when I first joined university, it was 2004, and still the majority of students, at least in Greece, were going to the libraries. So, and you were like, oh, maybe I can Google something, but it wasn't the first thing that would come to your mind. Most people didn't have a smartphone. I think iPhone came out like around those years, right? And it wasn't necessarily affordable for everyone, which means that maybe you had someone in a university coming up with something and then someone else coming up with something similar in a different continent, yeah? And essentially the term data science brought all these different areas together. It's something I also talk about in my book and in my workshops, where I demystify this term. And so instead, because before that you had people saying, oh, I'm doing data mining, I'm doing computational intelligence. And in the 90s, maybe you'd have a master's in neural networks, like, and the neural networks fell out of favor and they were called something else. Yeah. And obviously this creates a very fragmented picture, which is difficult to sell. So when I started my PhD in 2012, hardcore academics, like from the old disciplines, like statistics, for example, they would say, oh, data science as a term, it's offensive because, you know, we've been doing these things for like 200 years and now they're rebranding it. But I mean, when anything that moves out of academia and goes into, let's say, the like the economy and the real world, in a way, has to be more marketable. And for better or for worse, data science was the term that was used, which is a bit funny because, I mean, salary-wise, maybe this is still the case. You can have someone who has studied statistics, and then they also, you know, they can learn a bit more coding and call themselves data scientists. And maybe this person will have a higher salary than someone who is like, oh, I'm a statistician, even if the background is more or less the same. So this can, I'm not saying this is always the case, but it can happen. And it's just the way that the market thinks. However, I think because AI sounds cooler as a term, we're going to see it being used and abused more often. But in reality, many of the companies that say I'm doing AI, they're just doing data science. And data science, usually in practice, it means one of three things. Is some companies, they're simply doing dashboards because that's all they need and that's all they understand. Then in the majority of cases, it's machine learning, which is a particular field, a particular instantiation of AI. And in some cases, it is statistics rebranded. Okay. And then maybe companies which are more conscious, they do like a mix of all those things and they actually know where they're heading to. But it's a lot of play on words deliberate confusion. I say deliberate because I think like service providers actually try to promote these terms, sometimes even abuse them.
Yeah. So in many cases, you could use them interchangeably at this stage.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that like in general technology, not just, I mean, maybe this will change in the future if things get regulated, but it's not like medicine that's what I call a high responsibility field, where if you make a mistake, someone dies. In most cases, in technology, you know, this is not happening, which means that there are no regulatory bodies, no professional qualifications, everything is moving very fast. And service providers, products, startups, bigger companies, whatever, they just try to use these terms in whatever way they can to get business, which is a bit funny, but I think that's the best analogy I can find, because I'm like, imagine if we live in some parallel reality, medicine was like this, and someone could come up with new medical terms all of a sudden and say, oh, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, and then they actually harm people. That's the situation in data science, the difference being that the substance doesn't really change and they're not harming people. It's just about improving the marketability of the terms. That's all.
Probably with technology, if you make a mistake, then a couple of brain cells die.
Yeah, exactly. That's just about it. It's a bit of a funny world. And I think we've seen a lot of this now recently, AI, data science aside, in the Silicon Valley and the layoffs. I think this kind of mentality has essentially helped inflated valuations and overhiring, which then these companies are like, oh, maybe not the opportunity to lay off some employees, right? It feels like sometimes, I don't know, for some of those companies, it's very difficult to be honest, like you have to oversell everything. Maybe it's, I don't know, part of the Silicon Valley model. That's a very big conversation. But it's how things are, for better or for worse.
And maybe talking a little bit more about data science and AI, let's call it one bigger category, and maybe even stats, right? Especially with ChatGPT, right? Now it's I mean, I can see like a big shift almost. Like there was a lot of talk about AI, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, and then everything was blockchain and Web3, but since ChatGPT, everything is AI again, right? Where do you see, and maybe let's talk about, where do you see AI evolving in the next 2, 3, or maybe 5 years? How fast do you think it will now evolve, given it has gone completely mainstream?
I think it's going to evolve very fast for a couple of reasons. One is that there's going to be more investment flowing into it. because we transition from big data and glorified dashboards to actual AI. It's a bit primitive in the sense that it's not like Terminator level AI, but it's still some sort of artificial intelligence. And at the same time, it looks like we've cracked the code in certain things. So, for example, ChatGPT is not using any kind of novel methodology. It's just using existing algorithms combined in a very nice way, and in and with lots of data behind it. So, which means that we're going to see further advances without us having to wait for some kind of insane breakthrough. At the same time, computers will keep getting more powerful. Memories will keep increasing. Computer memory, maybe we'll see quantum computers being usable in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, who knows. So that's only going to increase. Now, how AI is going to be used by society, by companies, that's a different matter altogether. ChatGPT is a very particular type of AI for particular applications. So it looks like the companies that own these algorithms, they want to essentially commoditize them to the extent that they can, simply because that's a better business model. It remains to be seen, how the space will evolve. I expect that in terms of data science per se, data science will still be around, simply because most companies, the value they can extract from data simply revolves around, cleaning up the data and doing some visualizations, building some basic models, not necessarily around AI per se, but as AI keeps improving and, gets more and more commoditized, I would expect in the future that maybe companies would lay off half their marketing department because they can do creatives like in a better way through artificial intelligence. It's a very big conversation trying to figure out which jobs are a threat or not and which jobs are going to be enhanced. So, for example, software development. Are they going to completely be replaced by AI? Maybe in some cases. I still don't know. It remains to be seen. Even though I think everyone's surprised that AI, it seems that the first victims of AI and automation are the creatives, because everyone was always saying, oh, it's actually human creativity, a machine can never achieve this. It's going to be like simpler tasks which AI will automate. Surprisingly, it looks like what we've nailed is human language, which was considered the most difficult, thing to master, and obviously image generation. And I guess there's a good reason for that. I think it's because in language, as well as images, in the majority of applications, they're like just fluff. As in, if you look into most blog posts of the internet, especially like copywriting, it's not anything substantial. As in, it's not like a mathematical proof. It's the same with images. You can create a nice image, but it's not like a diagram that an architect would create, and if it's incorrect, then the house is going to come crashing down. So there's lots of, so even though it's difficult to master the rules of grammar and syntax, I think that there's lots of flexibility in terms of expressing something and then a human perceiving this as correct, or it's just one more opinion or whatever. And I think this is why this type of creativity was replicated by AI quite successfully. Now, what I think might be more difficult to do, and remains to be seen, is more specialized creativity, the kind of thing that very few people, like Steve Jobs, was able to do, to say, oh, that's my vision for Apple. I see this device. I'm going to come this way. That's something which is very difficult, because it requires an understanding of, society and the current trends, plus have a very wide view. I'm not sure how that would go. I guess these are like kind of unanswered questions and speculation.
But I guess there are not that many people to replace of that caliber.
That's true.
There are maybe 10 in the world right now.
Yeah, it's like saying I want
to.
No, I was going to say it's like saying I want an AI that can play basketball like Michael Jordan or, LeBron James. You're not looking for this kind of dexterity in robotics.
Correct. It doesn't need to scale.
Yeah.
I want to combine a couple of topics that you just mentioned. So that was great. So your view on the future of AI and jobs and all that. You also earlier mentioned culture and companies, right, and how that's evolving. Mm. No, just a bit of a background. Mangta started because of the pandemic, because we saw the shift in mindset, culture around remote work, mm-hmm. and that's something we really wanted to make more reliable and less of the Wild West, right? Mm-hmm. Now, here's a question, and I don't know if you have an opinion on this. How do you feel like, not just taking away jobs, but more of enhancing, what will be the role of AI and data science in the field of a remote workforce? Do you feel that in the space of talent acquisition, talent vetting, people joining new organizations in a remote manner, do you feel AI will play a big role in the near-term future?
Yeah, I think it can definitely enhance remote work in a few different ways. I mean, look, the main ways that the reason to be in an office, in a company, there might be a few reasons, but I think the main one is to build a culture. The second one is that I think offices are more useful for junior employees that require constant feedback and quite often constant supervision. Yeah. So if you have an AI that can actually, is advanced, as in it can, write, for example, text to the level that you desire, that you need it, right, in terms of copywriting, or it can evaluate how good, a piece of text is for a particular application. If you have this, then this kind of supervision can actually be replaced by an AI. So the cultural element is going to still be there. But where I'm going with this is that maybe when you have someone working in a country and English is not the first language, and then they use, for example, an AI to produce a piece of text, and then there's, let's say, another algorithm which gives them feedback as to how this closely resonates with, what they need to produce according to some guidelines. And this can speed up this feedback and training process, yeah? And I'm not talking about replacing, I'm talking about improving. It's the same with junior coders. I think that AI could actually help improve their quality of the code, so instead of maybe code reviews can take place more automatic in an automated fashion. These are like some of the thoughts I have, but obviously the interesting thing is that giving this type of feedback is probably more difficult than what ChatGPT is doing now, because ChatGPT is good with very open-ended stuff like, oh, tell me about this, or produce some code. And it's like, oh, it produces some code. When you have something which has to be evaluated with stricter criteria, there's still work we need to do. But probably eventually it's going to get there. And yes, I do help that. I do think this is going to help with remote working. And I guess this is also is the wider field of education, because now what we're talking about is learning and receiving feedback. This can happen on all levels of a company in terms of training, and maybe even in higher education eventually, or university education in general. Who knows? But I think it's going to happen.
Yeah, and I have so many more questions to ask. But I also want to talk very specifically on the philosophy of the mind. I want to go a little bit there, if I may, later, even talking economics. And I know that we're running out of time. Mm. I do want to have one last question on AI. What worries you about AI?
Good question. I think what worries me is that we don't know what it's going to look like in 5 or 10 years from now. There's speculation, but no convincing answer. And I say we don't know what it's going to look like. We don't really know what the impact of it is going to be on society. I hear many people talking with conviction that, yes, it's going to replace jobs, and we're going to have some kind of universal basic income. I don't know whether there will be like new jobs. But we also don't know. We know it's going to get better. We don't know how much better it's going to be. And I think this uncertainty is something that worries me, in the sense that I don't feel the current systems that we have in place in terms of government policy, regulation, are ready for this kind of change and at that pace. And I think we get a taste of how inefficient the systems are with blockchain, which has been the hottest technology since the big data craze. And you see how fast crypto has developed and how slow governments have been to do anything. If anything, they're just, being reactive. They're not being proactive. And I'm afraid this might eventually happen with AI. We might see AI being used in all sorts of ways, and then the government will try to do, to fix things after something has happened. And it's probably going to be too little too late. So it remains to be seen. I guess we could be talking about this for hours, because like there are many angles to it, from data ethics to AI ethics, to how this is going to affect the economy, to whether universal basic income is sustainable or even desirable. There are also some of those questions, they're not just technical. Some of them are philosophical in nature or ideological. Like, I believe society should function in this way. Like, let me give you an example. So I believe that it's likely that China might get ahead of the US and the Western world in general in the AI race, simply because of their very lax regulations around data and how AI is being used. Okay. Is this something desirable, yes or no? And you see there are also questions there that take into account the possibility of a third world war. Like, oh, if you know, maybe we want to have better, you know, data standards and ethics around data. But if, for example, China becomes a superior, power compared to the US and its allies, do we actually believe that we can sustain our standard of living and our way of living in face of such a threat? Or maybe China is not really a threat. Maybe, you know, it's someone we should collaborate to. And so this extends beyond data science, beyond AI, into the realm of policy, politics, what perception society will have of, you know, how we see essentially our future. Like, globalization now is shifting gear more towards localization. And I think we're going to hear like many opinions over the next, you know, the next few years. On a wider scale, I believe that societies and countries that manage to navigate this landscape better, they're going to find themselves in a much better position. But I guess getting it right takes a combination of, you know, determination, leadership, vision, and probably some luck, to be honest with you.
And talking about reactive regulations and policy, let's go a little bit about Web3, right? You mentioned token economics and auditing these type of systems, right? Which is clearly absolutely necessary given what's happening and what has happened. Very quickly for everyone, so how would you define token economics? And tell us a little bit more about auditing all of this and what you would typically audit.
Yeah, that's a great question. So token economics is simply the study of token economies, where token economies is an economy based on a blockchain, where the currency used is a blockchain-based currency and not a fiat currency per se. And the difference between token economics and fiat economics is that fiat economics are controlled by central banks, whereas blockchain token economics, they're controlled by a particular entity, whether it's a centralized company or a decentralized, like a DAO. And the incentive structures in that particular economy, they're arbitrary in the sense that they're decided by the company or the community. Yeah. So that's like the very general description. Now, the goal of a token of studying token economics and modeling them is to make sure that the economy created by the token facilitates the goals that this particular company is going to achieve, which again, it's a bit open-ended because there's so many different use cases. For example, if you create a stable coin, then what you are aiming to do is maintain a peg. If you create a borrowing and lending platform, then your goal is to match borrowers and lenders and minimize risk or maybe maximize returns. There might be different principles at play depending on your priorities and the risk profile of your users. The token economy has to align with those objectives, because otherwise, for example, as we saw with Terra Luna, it aligned with those objectives up to a point. The design had certain flaws, and when there were some, you know, external factors, then it came crashing down. And this is where auditing comes in play. So auditing, it's funny because I stumbled upon token economics out of personal interest, because I was in love with agent-based modeling, and it's something I never really got to apply in my career. And then when tokenomics became a thing, I'm like, hey, all these tools I've been using, they can be applied here. So I started writing about this. So there was very little conversation about analyzing tokenomics in 2017, and then startups started reaching out to me because of that. So then I'm like, okay, yeah, I can help you with that. So then I started doing more and more research and work in this area. And then agent-based modeling became a thing. And 2 years ago, I was contacted by a stablecoin, BackX, saying, hey, I need someone to audit our design. And then another company called Algem.io asked me to do the same for it's a DeFi protocol, Liquid Lending, asked me to do the same. And that's when I realized that in 2017 and 18, I was mostly being contacted by startup founders who wanted to create something from scratch. And now, because the sophistication and the complexity has increased, I was being contacted a lot by companies that had set something up, but this had reached the economy had reached the level of complexity. They felt they can no longer like understand themselves. They needed like an external, essentially partner, someone with an independent view to really say, yeah, I mean, this is, there are some weak points here, or there's some things we can improve upon, et cetera, et cetera. So I found myself essentially moving from doing the design from, you know, zero to from A to B, to just taking a token economy and saying, look, these are the weak points, these are the strong points, we can, you know, we can make some improvements so then it becomes more robust. And I realized that other people started talking about this theme, yeah? And that's when I'm like, okay, probably we need to try and formalize this process, because after what happened with Terra Luna, with FTX, we need to have some kind of standard with the eventual goal in 10 years or so that tokenomics are going to be audited, you know, in the similar way to which, let's say, an entity like PwC might audit the accounts of a big corporation. And this might be a legal requirement in the future. And that's why I also recently joined Haken, and we started the tokenomics auditing team. And essentially our goal behind tokenomics auditing is to first and foremost make sure that the token economy is robust and achieves the goals that the founders claim it's going to achieve, then improve it if those goals are not achieved, and then finally give a score similar to the scores that are given by credit rating agencies so that the users can make an informed decision. And I think this is where most of the complexity lies in, because if you look into Terra Luna again, which I think is the most famous example of a big project crashing in recent history, other than FTX, but FTX was an exchange, which also required auditing, but not mostly for its accounts, not so much its tokenomics. Terra Luna was a good design with certain flaws. So the rating wouldn't be a AAA, yeah, but it wouldn't be a CCC. So it worked well under certain conditions. And this is a thing where many users, many retail investors or high net worth investors, this is where they find it difficult to wrap their hands around, because it's like the real economy. Like, the real economy works well under certain conditions and takes a lot of effort and fine-tuning to make things operate smoothly. And I think the current situation we live in, with inflation, with stimulus, with interest rates, demonstrates this. And now token economics, the whole field has found itself in a similar level of complexity, where it's not a black or, like, you know, it's not black or white, it's mostly a gray area. And this is why we need to formalize this. So auditing token economies and assigning a risk score stops being the matter of subjective opinion, and there is at least an element of objectivity. Yeah. And this is really one of our principles. And I hope that, I mean, in the next few months, I've sent the paper, I submitted it. I'm planning to publish in the Journal of the British Blockchain Association the first guidelines for tokenomics auditing, which I'm not claiming is the end-all be-all, and I don't expect these guidelines to stay the same in 5 years, but we need to start somewhere. that's my thesis.
That's phenomenal, and I wish we had a lot more time. I would like to cover the key topics of audits, the audit, right, and what are the key components. By the way,
I did part two.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, I did a thesis on distributed systems and agent based modeling. So I have many more questions on that for you. But again, there's a much bigger question I'd like to ask as my final one, Jackie. I promise. And that is, I like to go full circle, mm-hmm. right? You started with the philosophy of the mind, mm-hmm. right? You moved into, let's say, data science, AI, which are kind of replicating human minds to a certain extent, or at least aspire to, right? As you've been on this journey, what have you really learned from that angle, from a philosophy of the mind angle, since you made that shift?
Ah, that's actually a great question. What I've learned, and this might come to the surprise of many listening to this, is that while the mind is very complex, it's actually much simpler than we thought it is. So don't forget, my first degree was in cognitive psychology, and I had also some basic training in clinical psychology, psychoanalysis, etc. And for centuries, we had different models of the mind and the psyche and emotions, whatever word you want to use for any of those entities. And I mean, if you also take into account religions and religious history, this, you know, we're talking about, you know, theories that extend for thousands of years, you know, into human history, trying to understand the human mind. And yes, humans are very complex and in some cases unpredictable. But essentially, all these theories, they try to put humans into some kind of box. And I think with the rise of data and also the rise of the internet, which has seen us like interacting online, like many different people from like all over the world constantly, we've accumulated lots of data points and data, which then gave rise to things like ChatGPT, right? And these things act like as a mirror, you know, for ourselves. And again, you know, again, using the ChatGPT example and the example of language, many have realized that maybe humans, at least in some aspects, are not as complicated as we thought they are. Or maybe the human mind, yes, it's wonderful, but maybe it's limited. Maybe it's something we can actually replicate. And I think we witness this paradigm shift from, I think, in culture as well. As in, if you look many movies in the 90s, like about the narrative of how amazing it is to be human and, you know, Terminator and this and that, there was lots of conversation around there about computers and AI and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, how in a way humans are something different. And I think we're kind of reaching a different narrative now because we now we have, you know, new generations which are digital natives, and then the generations after them are going to be AI natives. So I think in 2-3 generations from now, humans will be like, oh, actually AI is smarter than us in many different ways and can do things better than we do. That's like a surprising conclusion for myself as someone who originally in his career, even though I'm not doing this now, let's say, as a researcher in a professional capacity, I was determined to try and find out, to unlock the you know, secrets of the human mind. But one thing that definitely the original visionaries of AI and cognitive science got correct is that the best way to study the human mind, it seems, was to essentially try to study like the different functions. Because if you go 70 years into the past, you'll see that cognitive science with neuroscience, with AI, with computer science, they had many synergies. That's why, again, if you study things like linguistics and you see Chomsky's like theories about the human language, he borrowed many things from computer science. And this kind of thinking now, it's a given. And essentially breaking things down has helped us understand them. And this has been something very, very fascinating for me. And again, there's another probably like example I can mention here. I was reading this a few years ago, when things like Transformers first came out, like not the robots, the neural networks that ChatGPT is based upon. And I remember reading a quote that, you know, before deep neural networks, companies that wanted to use to develop natural language applications, they would often hire computational linguists, etc. And I remember a quote by someone saying that every time I fire a linguist, it seems like the performance of my model increases. And that's funny because we had humans in the whole field of study of the human language, and then we have an algorithm that just reads Wikipedia articles, and then it can just learn the rules of syntax and grammar without any external help. And that's probably another insight that maybe like the level of complexity of things like language is probably too high for, let's say, individuals to just craft rules and teach this to a machine. But it seems that we've been successful enough in using clever algorithms with insane amounts of data to replicate the functionalities of the human mind. Now, I don't want to go too philosophical and start talking about, you know, whether robots have emotions and all that, because I think these debates are a bit fake and superficial most of the time. I think the most interesting debate around this area is around the functionalities, because I don't think anyone believes that ChatGPT has emotions or anything of that kind, even if, you know, the answers are very intelligent.
But yeah, then you can go and debate what is an emotion really, and you know, and then maybe it becomes a gray area, right? I don't know.
Not necessarily so.
I think it's a fascinating topic.
No, anyhow. But you know what? I think that's a question of what is consciousness. And the thing, unless you take a very abstract philosophical type of stance, we know that consciousness is a property of living organisms. They need to have some kind of nervous system. So we definitely know that the computer cannot have like emotions. Now, there might be some arguments against this thesis, as in, whether there can be things without the neural system that have consciousness. You know, there was this theory that maybe the Earth is conscious and whatnot, or whether there are creatures, which like viruses, which again, they seem to have some kind of intelligence, maybe on the collective level, but they don't have a nervous system, and they might be intelligent, and things like that. It gets a bit too philosophical at that point, but I like to be a bit pragmatic. It's one more thing I didn't like in academia, at least in that particular area, that I'm like, okay, in the end of the day, does this really affect our lives? And the thing with AI and large language models is like, oh, is it really going to take my job? Or is it going to help my company? Is it going to affect the economy in a positive or negative way? You know, whereas like debating about how it feels about answering questions, it's probably a bit pointless given everything else.
Well, you know, with the AI not being capable of any emotion, Dr. Stelios, we love how passionate you sound and your passion about this field. So it's very nice to see you talk about your passions today. And it's very romantic how you said you fell in love with agent-based modeling.
Well, coming from somebody that actually loves Optimus Prime from the Transformers.
Me too.
Yeah. Did you see her eyes go up when you say Transformers? Yeah.
No, I like Transformers as well as a kid, but I was referring to the neural. Well, AI practitioners have emotions in contrast to AI creations. So, you know, maybe add this in the notes as well.
Yes. It's going to be long, long notes.
Let's not ChatGPT describe that.
Yeah, we'll just feed it. Now, for organizations or businesses interested in connecting with you, Stelios, where can they best find you or how can they best get in touch with you?
Yeah, that's easy. First of all, there's my personal website, thedatascientist.com. That we have plans. This year we're going to turn it into a publication, so we're also accepting guest articles, featured articles on topics relating to AI, data science, technology, and Web3. That's one, thedatascientist.com. Then Tesseract Academy, that's Tesseract with double S, dot Academy. And then finally, if you want to become a data scientist, check out Beyond Machine. It's beyond /machine.com. I guess all this information will be in the notes. And I'm always happy to connect to people on LinkedIn.
Absolutely.
Just make sure to add the note saying you listen to this podcast, because I receive like a million invites a day. And sometimes it's like random people on LinkedIn. So just good, you know, if I know you actually at least listen to this podcast and you're not just a random person on the internet. Thank you.
Absolutely. And your books, you can definitely find it
on Amazon.
Website.
Yeah, you Google my name.
It's also available on Amazon.
Yeah, it's the Decision Makers Handbook for Data Science and then Business Model in Emerging Technologies. I have an Amazon author account. So if you Google my name, Kampakis, Stylianos Kampakis on Amazon, you'll find them. Third book called Uncertainty should be coming out this summer. It depends a bit on my publisher and their timelines.
Fantastic. So it's a wrap for today's episode of Mangtas Nation. Thank you so much, Dr. Stelios, for taking the time to be with us today. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and learned a lot of things. Definitely check out our show notes, our lengthy show notes. Mm-hmm. Everything will be listed down there. And we promise to be back next time with another great episode. Doctor, thank you once again.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Now, once again, this is Jackie DeMank.
And Wouter Delbare.
Stay tuned for the next episode of Mangtas Nation.
Thank you for tuning in to Mangtas Nation. Mangtas, your curated marketplace for B2B outsourcing solutions. Follow our social media pages to know more about us. Sign up as a client or sign up as a vendor and be part of this global B2B marketplace. Join us at www.mangtas.com.